McNeil. Worldwide, the number of coronavirus deaths rose to about 120,000 and the number of confirmed cases jumped to 1.9 million. U.S. deaths approached 24,000 and the number of confirmed cases is less than a third of the worldwide figure. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says that New York's death toll from the virus has topped 10,000, with hospitals still seeing 2,000 new patients a day. The death tally hit the milestone only about a month after the state recorded its first death. The state tallied 671 new deaths on Sunday. It was the first time in a week the daily toll tipped below 700. Still, the governor noted Monday that people are still dying at a horrific level of pain and grief and sorrow. Meanwhile, New York City's health department says the city is in danger of running out of swabs for COVID-19 tests and should test only hospitalized patients. Japan's health ministry said Tuesday that the country had 390 new cases of the virus for a domestic total of 7,645 as of the end of Monday. The country, which separately had 712 cases from a cruise ship quarantined near Tokyo earlier this year, now has a combined total of 8,357 cases with 121 deaths. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe declared a state of emergency in Tokyo and six other prefectures deemed at the highest risk of the coronavirus infection explosion. He has asked the people to stay at home and keep social distancing as much as 80%. However, many people were still seen queuing up at grocery stores and crowding shopping centers and arcades in downtown Tokyo. This is VOA News. Storms that killed more than 30 people in the southeast United States are spreading misery atop a pandemic as they move up the East Coast. The severe weather outbreak that began on Easter in the Deep South caused floods, mudslides, and more than 1 million power outages by Monday. Officials say 11 died in Mississippi, 8 more died in Georgia. Other deaths were reported in Arkansas, Tennessee, and the Carolinas. The severe weather outbreak came with much of the nation shut down because of the new coronavirus. In Alabama, people huddled into community storm shelters, wearing protective masks to guard against the threat. China is turning its eye to its northeastern border with Russia in a bid to stamp out a possible second wave of coronavirus infections. It comes as the country's number of new daily cases rose to its highest in nearly 6 weeks, with more than 90% of those involving people coming from abroad. Half involved Chinese nationals returning from Russia's far eastern federal district. Having largely stamped out domestic transmission, China has been slowly easing curbs on movement as it tries to get its economy back on track, but there are fears that a rise in imported cases could spark a second wave of the virus. Chinese immigration officials said the country has cut the number of people crossing its borders by 90% and has tried to stop all non-essential journeys. Thousands of displaced Syrians have begun moving back to their homes in war-torn Idlib province, despite the risk of renewing conflict, some driven by fear that the new coronavirus could wreak havoc on the cramped camps near the Turkish border. The choices are grim for Syrian refugees, remaining tightly packed at camps near the Turkish border, where the coronavirus could spread like wildfire, or return to the war zone they fled from in Idlib province. As American workplaces and all manner of U.S. institutions are forced to adapt amid the coronavirus pandemic, so too must the U.S. Supreme Court. The highest court in the land announced on Monday that for the first time, the 9 justices will hear cases argued by teleconference rather than in the courtroom. That includes a closely watched dispute over whether President Trump's tax and financial records should be disclosed. A court spokeswoman said that arguments in 10 cases will be heard by teleconferencing next month, and all of the justices will participate remotely. The change is highly unusual, as the court historically is resistant to embrace new technologies. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Kingdom of Eswatini has denied that King Mswati III has contracted the coronavirus.
There will be absolutely no reason to hide such information from the public if the king was ill. The king is well and continues to engage cabinet appropriately in respect of the COVID-19 regulations.
South Africa's ruling party is praised for its handling so far of the COVID-19 pandemic. Kenyan doctors say they lack adequate protective medical equipment. Zimbabwe journalists face challenges in covering COVID-19 news. And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari extends COVID-19 restrictions in parts of the country by 14 days.
The president was very clear in the broadcast to the nation when he said, "This is not a joke. It's a matter of life and death." That's a mark of the seriousness Mr. President attaches to the issue of COVID-19 in Nigeria.
Lyle Mohammed, Nigeria's information minister, and a new report points out obstacles to governance in central Mali. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. For the government of the Southern African Kingdom of Eswatini has denied media reports that King Mswati III has contracted the coronavirus. Sebalo Dlamini, acting spokesperson for the kingdom, says the reports peddled around by unnamed activists are fake news. His remarks followed reports that the king was admitted at the Mazenet Royal Hospital, where he is receiving medical attention. Critics say the government should ask the king to address his subjects. But acting government spokesperson Dlamini says the king usually relays information about the government through the prime minister and cabinet, who he says continue to engage him regularly.
It's fake news, Peter. His Majesty is very well and in good health.
Sabelo, what assurances is the government of Eswatini giving the people following this report, which has gone viral across the world?
There will be absolutely no reason, Peter, to hide such information from the public if the king was ill. The king is well and continues to engage cabinet appropriately in respect of the COVID-19 regulations. And just on Wednesday, he commissioned the hosting of virtual Easter services, which were broadcast live across the nation over the weekend.
Sabelo, how is your government handling issues of the coronavirus in the kingdom?
Peter, government introduced a partial lockdown on the 28th of March, where only essential services are allowed to continue. This followed the declaration of a national emergency by His Majesty the King. This partial lockdown, Peter, allows only workers in essential services to work and the public to only go out of their homes to replenish food supplies or seek medical attention. As I speak to you right now, Peter, on the 13th of April, there are 15 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the country, and 8 of these have recovered, tested negative, and have been discharged. Government continues to intensify information dissemination to the public and has trained health workers and rural motivators, among others, on COVID-19. There are many other measures that government has put in place to control the spread of the virus.
Sabelo, what do you say to the people of Eswatini, some of them who say that they need the king's assurances? They want to see him on TV and hear him on radio and other social media platforms, give them assurances regarding the implementation of measures to curb the spread of the coronavirus.
We can assure the public, Peter, that the king is well and healthy and will appear in public when necessary and at his chosen time. Right now, he remains very active and continues to engage with cabinet and other relevant authorities to give direction to the COVID-19 national fight.
Sebalo Dlamini is the acting spokesperson for the government of Eswatini. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotin from the capital, Mbabane. South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC, has been praised for its handling so far of the country's COVID-19 pandemic. The ANC quickly appointed a team of top scientists to work out strategies to curb the threat. It is sending medical personnel across the nation to test people for the virus. Even the ANC bitter political enemies have lauded the government for moving fast to lock South Africa down as it tries to slow the spread of COVID-19. However, the actions of two senior ANC officials have returned the party to negative headlines. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Key to driving a digital transform society is to ensure that the cost to communicate have been reduced.
South Africans love the ANC's Stella Ndabeni Abrams. They love to read about her in glossy magazines, which sometimes feature her because she's stylish and quite attractive. They love her colorful designer outfits. They love her warm smile. But most of all, citizens love Ndabeni Abrams for making them smile. For the country's Minister of Communications has been communicating with them in truly unique ways for more than a year now. Here's one example from February, with Ndabeni Abrams being questioned on ENCA TV by journalist Kholi Mgambi.
At a personal level, allegations have been leveled against you that you flew your husband on taxpayers' money all the way to Switzerland in order to celebrate the anniversary of your wedding. Is that true?
I've never been to Switzerland. My husband has never been to Switzerland. We went to Geneva and New York to do the work that I'm expected to do. It is a blatant lie.
Geneva is, of course, Switzerland's second largest city. It's an international finance hub and hosts a United Nations headquarters. Despite not knowing much about geography and despite the allegations of corruption, the limelight-loving minister kept her job, but she lost support after her latest escapade.
Fellow South Africans, I would like to convey an apology to President Cyril Ramaphosa, the South African society at large, for breaching lockdown rules put in place to cap the spread of COVID-19.
Lockdown law permits people classified as essential services, which Ndabeni Abrams is as a state minister, to leave their homes to work. Like other South Africans, she's allowed out to buy food and for medical attention. But the regulations prohibit social gatherings. But then Ndabeni Abrams was on an Instagram photo, tucking into a luxurious lunch with a group of friends, smiling as usual. For the first time ever, Stella was forced to appear on TV. Her smile was gone.
I regret the incident and I'm deeply sorry for my actions. I hope the president and you South Africans will find it in your hearts to forgive me. The president has put me on special leave.
The words were hardly out of the minister's mouth when another ANC official made a starring appearance in his very own viral video.
Go there and show that you are here as a soldier. But I think I'll work with you as the...
In the cell phone footage, the mayor of the town of Machabeng, Nkosinjani Spielman, achieves a stunning first for an ANC administrator. He manages to express racism, xenophobia, chauvinism, and incitement to violence in 31 seconds while addressing soldiers on lockdown duty. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Kenya Medical Practitioners and Doctors Union has cited the lack of personal protective equipment or PPEs as the leading cause of the spread of coronavirus among the health workers. Speaking in Nairobi yesterday, Monday, Union Chairperson Samuel Oroko said most doctors are overwhelmed with managing the pandemic. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenya has recorded 208 COVID-19 positive cases and 9 deaths.
It is exactly 1 month since normalcy was interrupted within Kenya after the country recorded its first case of COVID-19. Working conditions, education sector, transport sector, among others, have been interrupted with as the country still struggled to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking yesterday, Monday, Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe said that the country is still uncertain on when business will be as usual in the country.
In the last 24 hours, we have tested 674 samples. Out of these samples, 11 have tested positive for coronavirus disease. And so we have now passed the 200 mark. Our figure stands at 208. All the 11 are Kenyans. Four have a history of travel from the United Arab Emirates, aged between 1 year and 42 years. We have unfortunately lost one more patient in Nairobi.
The health ministry has also banned the food donation to the vulnerable people after stampede that claimed two lives in Kibera Slum, Nairobi, who were scrambling for food that was donated by former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Mutahi says at this time, any organization willing to give donations should channel to the designated government authority.
It is time indeed to lend a helping hand. We encourage benefactors at the county level, businesses, organizations, and individuals to liaise with the county leadership to ensure that their help is channeled in an organized manner. We'd particularly like to stop and desist from making any support that brings crowds of people together, because at that point, instead of helping, you may very well be spreading the disease.
At the same time, the medical practitioners in Kenya are raising concerns over the risk undertaken by the health officers. Kenya Medical Practitioners and Doctors Union Chairperson Samuel Oroko said that most of the doctors and nurses attending to COVID-19 patients do not have sufficient protective gears.
Working in partnership with the government to see what can be done within the available resources so that we can protect our people. But as we do that, we must remember all the time to protect the front line. We are sending our healthcare workers to the field empty-handed. So we want them to die? I don't think that's the plan.
Already, there are more than 10 health officers who came into contact with the patients that have tested positive for the virus. Union's Acting Secretary General Chibanzi Mwachonda said that most of the health officers are in quarantine and hence bringing shortage of the health workers.
It's 4 doctors who have confirmed positive, 10 nurses, 10 clinical officers, and over 70 other healthcare workers under quarantine as we speak, who are on the front line handling the patient. They're those who have been put in mandatory quarantine and those in the hospitals. And remember, even the child who died in KNH, Kenya National Hospital, those workers who had come into contact were exposed, so they're under quarantine. So we have a good number of workers who are under quarantine. And that means that when workers go on quarantine, when frontline workers, we have a depleted number of staff to continue responding to the pandemic.
Most affected counties in Kenya are on partial lockdown as the numbers reduce in the capital, Nairobi. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 14. COVID-19 news coverage on the front line comes with a set of its own challenges in Zimbabwe, from lack of resources to better relations with authorities. Reporter Kuzai Navashe has more from Harare.
Leopold Munende is a journalist and spokesperson of the Young Journalists Association.
Journalists are being harassed on a daily basis. We've had harassments in Harare, quite a number, in Chinoy, in Gweru, in Masvingo, Bulawayo, Mutare. So you see, it's now prevalent. Just on Friday, one of our members, Mary Taruvinga, who works for NewsMabu.com, was forced to marching or jumping the way soldiers do.
That episode of harassment took place less than 100 meters from the president's office. While Zimbabwe is on lockdown to limit the spread of COVID-19, journalists are among the essential employees allowed to be outdoors doing their work. At checkpoints, journalists are required to produce their media accreditation cards, which the Zimbabwe Media Commission, or ZMC, issues annually. However, the ZMC has not issued any 2020 accreditation cards because the agency was in the middle of reviewing renewal fees when the COVID-19 outbreak started. The ZMC has said journalists can continue using 2019 media cards, but those cards have been getting journalists in trouble with security personnel who say the cards are expired. Thabani Moyo is the director of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, in Zimbabwe. a media freedom non-profit organization that provides support and legal assistance to journalists. He says the organization has approached the courts to resolve the problem.
We are handling more than 14 cases in the forms of harassment, arrests, and attacks on the profession of journalism, that is, journalists and downstream distributors of their content, since the lockdown started. We have since approached the courts on an urgent application seeking relief that journalists should be allowed to do their work without maximum restrictions.
Moyo says they are hopeful the court will rule favorably. Njabulo Ncube is the national coordinator of the Zimbabwe National Editors Forum. He says if the media harassment persists, it will compromise the circulation of credible news about the pandemic.
The Zimbabwe National Editors Forum is appealing to the government to specifically alert and emphasize to law enforcement agents that journalists are an essential service.
Munende, with the Young Journalists Association, says journalists have run into other hurdles in covering the pandemic.
So we've had challenges in that we have a very limited access to personal protective equipment, which we need because we are really much on the front line. We are the ones who are going to Wilkins, to Thorngrove in Bulawayo, and to these other areas which are COVID-19 hotspots within the country. We are very much exposed to the danger of contracting this virus.
The lockdown also has grounded public transport, making it difficult for some journalists to get around to do their jobs. For VOA, this is Kudzai Navashi from Harare.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has extended coronavirus restrictions in Lagos and Ogun states, as well as the Federal Capital Territory of Abuja, by another 14 days. Addressing the nation Monday night, President Buhari said Nigeria had 323 confirmed cases of the virus in 20 states, and that Lagos State and the Federal Capital Territory remain the epicenters, accounting for 71% of all nationwide cases. The president also announced that palliative measures such as food distributions, cash transfers, and loans repayment waivers during the lockdown will continue, with an additional 1 million households. Information Minister Lai Mohammed says President Buhari appealed to Nigerians to continue to work with the government in the fight against the spread of COVID-19.
The president was very clear in the broadcast to the nation when he said, "This is not a joke. It's a matter of life and death." That's a mark of the seriousness Mr. President attaches to the issue of COVID-19 in Nigeria and the need to protect the lives of the citizens. The president is also keenly aware of the rising cases of COVID-19 globally and also locally in Nigeria.
If I'm not mistaken, I think Nigeria has a total number of, over 300 coronavirus cases. Is your case number leveling up or is it on the rise?
In Nigeria, Mr. President noted that the number of cases has gone up from 131 cases in 12 states on March 30th to 323 in 19 states and the Federal Capital Territory in just 2 weeks, while the number of deaths in Nigeria has gone up from 2 to 10 within that period. As Mr. President said, the repercussions of any premature end to the lockdown action are simply unimaginable. And in his words, "We must not lose the gains achieved thus far. We must not allow a rapid increase in community transmission. We must endure a little longer."
The president also announced an extension of the assistance program he announced recently. Can you tell us more about this?
Mr. President, if you remember, did announce a number of palliative measures even on the 30th of March. These include measures such as food distribution to affected areas, cash transfers, and loans repayment waivers. In addition to sustaining these measures, Mr. President has directed the expansion of the conditional cash transfer, which provides 5,000 naira monthly each to the more vulnerable households in Nigeria, from 2.6 million households to 3.6 million households in the next 2 weeks. That's an additional 1 million homes benefiting from the nation's social investment program. in fact, the biggest of its kind in Africa.
The African Union has raised concern about the treatment of Africans in China. How many Nigerians do you have in China? And any comment on what the African Union has said?
Nigeria has between 10 and 12,000 of its citizens in China and has been in touch with the Chinese authorities on the need to ensure that all Nigerians in China are well treated. My colleague, the Honorable Minister of Foreign Affairs, has summoned the Chinese ambassador in Nigeria over these reports and to also stress the need for Nigerians in China to be treated with the utmost respect and decorum. The African Union is right to have taken that issue up at the continental level, and I'm sure this will positively impact on how Africans in China are treated henceforth.
Lai Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. A new report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute looks at the main challenges in governance in central Mali. One of the report's authors, Mamadou Boudian, tells Ricky Schreier that the main obstacle to governance in Mali is that the country lacks central services such as infrastructure and education.
In the majority of the population, for example, 53% of our respondents say that they prioritize consulting traditional authorities in the event of serious crime. And this is really an important finding. And it means that rather than turning to the state, people mostly rely on traditional authorities who play essential roles and hold significant powers in their community. And people in these regions claim to trust the customary system, justice system, and perceive it more impartial than the modern justice system.
Are there ways forward that would integrate more the traditional and customary justice systems with the quote-unquote formal federal system, I guess, that you think that you guys found would help increase security in the region?
Well, I think there's been some kind of duality between the formal system and the traditional system, even though at times the state tried to rely on traditional leaders as proxies when it comes to handling issues at the local level. But I think there should be more effort from the state to integrate this traditional system in the overall justice system, because more and more people rely on these traditional leaders because they are mediators and they help really diffuse tensions at the local level. Of course, now their power, but also their role is becoming more and more challenged by the role of these new actors, Islamic actors, especially in certain parts of central Mali.
Beyond obviously the historical and cultural context and all of these other factors, what role does economics play?
Well, I think Mali is struggling. You know, the country is at the intersect of many challenges, as I say, in terms of governance, security, and development. But I believe that the entry point of any intervention aiming at resolving the current situation should be to emphasize the need and priorities of local people. And that's what we're trying to do. So we study people's perception and try to bring this, what they think is more important at the local level, because it's good to have an idea of what people think is more important, or what they think is the priority. But of course, Mali is getting an incredible support from the international community. I'm not talking about us, this kind of bilateral cooperation and military intervention to help the Malian state recover its territory, but also have the monopoly of legitimate use of violence. But we also have development actors who are intervening.
Mamadou Boudian is a researcher at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He was speaking with Reki Stryak from Sweden. That's it for this Tuesday, April 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping you have a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clote, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.05 and 20.05 UTC, right after the international news.